Good evening, everyone, and welcome to tonight's stream. It is, of course, the Book Club, and we've got another fantastic book review for you tonight. We are live to do this book review on Rumble and Odyssey. Please do share the links. And it's a fantastic book written by our good friend and friend of Patriotic Alternative, Sasha Rossmuller. I've had the pleasure of meeting him on several occasions and he even travelled to England to give a speech at a PA conference. So it's a real pleasure to have him here tonight. We've also got Natty and Aunt Sally. So there's a full panel of us to review this. And we've got to say, if you like what you're hearing, and if you want to support the stream, you can give a donation directly through Rumble. If anyone's got any questions, you can ask them through Rumble at any time. And you can also donate to my work via my crypto, all the crypto links in the description below. You can write to me at mark@thefallofwesternman.com, and you can now also subscribe to my Substack. The link is in both chats and it's the pinned comment. So that's how you can get in touch. That's how you can get involved. That's how you can contribute to the stream. Now, obviously, there's going to be a lot to say tonight. There always is on book clubs, and sometimes we run slightly over. So for the sake of making sure we get started on time and finished on time, let's get into it. And we'll start by welcoming Sasha to the stream. You all know him. He's a wonderful German nationalist. For my money, he is the greatest living German nationalist. And I'm always disappointed that he doesn't get the appreciation he deserves, both from his contemporaries in Germany and Austria, and also, you know, from the wider community, because he is a workhorse. He's been doing this for his whole adult life, and his contributions to the cause have been absolutely above and beyond what you could expect from any mortal man. And this book just adds to it. So we're going to start by welcoming you tonight, Sasha, and asking, firstly, how are you? I hope you're well. I hope the weather over there is not as overbearingly warm and sticky as it is here. But also to ask you, what motivated you to write this book?
Thank you for inviting me. And you are the champion of the most kindest introductions for podcasts and live streams globally, for sure. Thank you for that. I highly appreciate it. That's always a huge motivation to start. So let's get ready to rumble. Yes, the weather, it's right now here, we have extraordinary stormy weather, raining cats and dogs, I think, like you say it in Britain, and really stormy. Maybe that's also the cause why sometimes a little bit the sound is not as good as usually when we are online, but I could understand you. And directly to your question, what motivated me to write this book? I by myself, I always was looking for a kind of such a book, but didn't really find what I was looking for. And I always wanted a book which is writing the or explaining or for the reader approaching the Occidental history, not only by the bloodshed and by the war trenches and the world wars or military history, but to approach on the civilizational highlights, on the cultural highlights, and from a particular perspective, from the perspective of identity. And I didn't really find a piece where that kind of approach described from the perspective of an ethno-nationalist, and so I decided to do it by myself, to offer it for some comrades maybe looking as I did for a book like this. But of course, I'm fully aware that this topic is a niche topic, and the interested readers, we are able to count on our hands. But I think it is important to make that offer, to give an hors d'oeuvre, to incite the comrades for more appetite to engage in culture. because it's the identity basis on two pillars. The one pillar is our genetic makeshift, our autochthonous indigenous people, our countrymen we are fighting for. And the other pillar of our identity is is our culture, by which we communicate generation spanning, so to say. And I'm not sure if we are able to survive or to succeed in fight back the foreign infiltration without recognizing ourselves, recognizing who we are in our identity, as one of the seven sages, Chilon von Sparta, said, and is inscripted in the Apollo Temple of Delphi, Knothi Siauton, recognize yourself. And I think that's an important topic. And I liked writing the book because it was it thrilled me engaging in these topics and in that matters. And it's a very personal writing because it's very subjective regarding what I elected to put into this book, because I wanted to make not an encyclopedia, and I'm not an academic on this. I wanted to write it as an ethno-nationalist from the identitarian perspective. And I wanted to write, we live in times of digitalization, and unfortunately, people don't read as much as they did in the times of our fathers and grandfathers. So it should be also a manageable volume, in particular for our younger comrades. That was the motivation.
I'll just ask a couple of follow-up questions, Sasha, if that's okay. Did you actively travel to write this book? Did you go and visit some of the places you're writing about and some of the architecture and the art that you went to see and write about? Was that the process for writing that book, or was that something that you were doing from memory or from research?
Yes, indeed. Not all places. Not all artificial works described in this book I have personally visited, but some of them I really have admired in standing before that. For example, in Breslau, or for example, the Uffizis in Florence, or in some things in Dresden, or in several countries, or I visited those artifacts. I have seen those artifacts, or regarding the literature, regarding the literature mostly of what I'm writing in this book, I really extensively or intensively read personally, but not every single artifact. It would have been too time-consuming and too expensive for me, but I'm still alive and I'm not dead. So I will be able to contemplate in front of the those artifacts I haven't seen yet. But a part of that book also was a research from out of literature or documentaries and so. But the reader of the book can read where on which places I've been personally.
I was going to say it was quite entertaining, because there are parts of the book that almost read like a European nationalist travel guide, you know, like you'd find in the back of a newspaper or something. And clearly your love of the places you've seen, or the artifacts you're seeing and talking about, kind of shines through, and you make recommendations of visiting it.
Yes, indeed, that was very, very intentional to give the reader the opportunity to read that book as a kind of a travel guide, because I want that our comrades become acquainted with our Occidental world. And to become acquainted with our Occidental world, you have to see places. You have to make these experiences with these places. You have to take home to you the memories of having been there, or you have to meet the folks of other countries, other people, and that was really intentional. And so, for example, I mentioned, for example, if a certain picture of, let's take John William Waterhouse, because he's a British, and I love him, that it's in the gallery in Manchester, for example, said, so that a German comrade who is reading this and then starts looking a few more pictures of Waterhouse and agrees with my estimation that he is wonderful, maybe that's an incentive for him to say, oh, let's go, let's make a trip to Manchester, let's go to the gallery, not only to the pub, let's stand before this picture, and maybe let's plan that trip beforehand, Mark Collett, if there is also some a demonstration I can partake also. So that really was intentional.
Well, I certainly, when you were talking about the Rocklaw Town Hall, the beer hall in, I think it's pronounced, I don't know how it's pronounced. Is it Rocklaw?
The Polish call it Wroclaw. The German name, it was a German town, is Breslau. It's a very private anecdote regarding that topic, because my grandfather from my mother's side was from the Eastern German part, not was called or is seen as Eastern Germany today, the Eastern German part of the old Reich, which is now in under the administration of Poland. And due to this family relation, I regularly visit Silesia and also the town Breslau, which is called the Florence of Eastern Europe, and rightly so. And this town hall here it's amazing beautiful, and there is I think it will be one of the oldest restaurants or the oldest beer pubs in continuation in the whole world. It started in the 13th century, nearly uninterrupted up today, and I have been three times in my life taking a beer in that town hall, and also Goethe, for example, had been also there. And there is a saying in Breslau or in Wroclaw, like the Polish translation is to this city today, is that if it's called the Schweidnitz Keller, if you haven't been in the Schweidnitz Keller, then you haven't been in Breslau.
Well, if I ever go to Breslau, I'm certainly having a beer down there.
Yes, you have. It's a must see. Believe me, it's a must see. And it's an amazing place. And you will receive memories for your life. I promise you, you won't regret it.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks. That's all the questions I have so far. So I'll hand it to Sally or Mark.
Yeah, Sally, how are you doing? You enjoying the what feels like the beginning of the summer? I hope you're well. Well, I mean, obviously, summer begins from a calendar point of view, I believe, tomorrow. But how are you feeling?
I'm fine. I'm doing well. I've enjoyed this book. I've really enjoyed this book. And first, I want to confess to Sasha, but I'm not very cultured. I'm a reasonably intelligent peasant. It's not my world. It's not my world. My world was something else, especially martial arts for the last, or many, many years. Most of my youth was devoted to martial arts. So I wasn't in this world of culture, although I did go to grammar school. So I did learn Latin. And then I got married and had children, and that was that. So what I found really interesting about it is that, you know, apart from the travel recommendations, which hopefully I can get to go to, but what I loved about it was it's not a huge book. It's only 159 pages or something. But every page, there's something on it that will take you somewhere else. So it was like you're reading about these poets, and then I'm Googling the work of these poets. And then next thing, an hour's gone by, and I still haven't read another line of the book, which is what I mean. And the same with the artist, when you get to talking about the artist, and then literally 4 hours later, after looking at all these artists, I'm some of it's just amazing. It's just, I really get why you've named these people. And I just love some of the poets as well. Particularly, I must ask you before I forget, Katerina Kopp, I wrote it down, her. I can't find any of her work online. So we'll talk about that after. But so every page took me somewhere else. And it took me a long time to read the book, to finish it without going off on a tangent on something else. But yeah, I just want to thank you for it.
That's really nice, and I'm so glad to hear. And if this book, especially if someone takes this book to the hand, who says this is usually not his world he is engaged in, that's excellent hearing this, because I, as I said in the beginning, I wanted to make appetite to engage in culture and in art, and to incite in learning a little bit about this world. And as I also in the preface have written, that this book is not written by a pundit of the university, or it's not from a academic perspective, but from a identitarian perspective. It's from the perspective that comes from my heart, and I think beauty matters, and we political dissidents in our daily struggle, we face so much challenges and often backlashes, and have our fights, our legal fights before court and everything. And I wanted maybe, or I hope, or I would be very, very glad if this book could, the readers in our community, could prevent in depressive moments for our comrades and our activists becoming resignating. If they have the feeling to resignate, or if they lack the, or even especially younger comrades lack the immediate success in politics, that maybe if they take this book, or if they become acquainted to engage in culture and handle with the beauties of our European heritage, maybe that will help to recharge their batteries in depressive moments. And when you said that it's not your world, and despite this, you nevertheless finished reading the book. I'm very glad to hear that you didn't stop after page 17 finished it.
I've come away from it with a new appreciation of the arts. I mean, the arts were always there. I'm not a total philistine, is that the right word even? But the arts were always there, and I do read books. But I take away a new appreciation, and I actually want to know more. And I understand why they must not be ignored, which is all in your conclusion. I don't want to get to the end before we get to anything else. But your conclusion was excellent. But yeah, it must be valued and shared. But one question I had was, because I think you said you went to grammar school as well, but when you were at school, was your German art, was that taught to you, or was that hidden?
No, that was not taught in school where I have been. To be honest, my remembrance on the art lessons in my school time was more or less that they have been very, very boring. They gave us some colors and a paper and said try to do a little bit, and we completely lacked becoming instructed about those theoretical fringe informations I tried to give in that book. They just gave us a pencil or some colors and a little bit of paper, and end of the show. And indeed, for a long time in my life, it also haven't been my world. To be honest, that intensified really from the birth of my son, around about 25 years ago, or when my wife was pregnant 26 years ago. When I, because of my own school experience, I thought, how wanna I try to shape or impress or educate my own son, and how will I show him his home country, his region, or his continent, or how will I make him acquainted with the history? And if you have a family, you're good advised to, even as a political revolutionary dissident, to take enough time to spend it with your family, in particular by when educating children. And so we started visiting castles or such things very early. For example, when I mentioned that I have been in Florence and within in the gallery, the Uffizian, the Uffizis, it was when my son was 13 years young, and I showed him this famous gallery in Florence and spent time with him and also with my wife, and that's an everlasting experience, and I'm sure he will do the same with his children. And we, from time to time, we talk about this, and from we made a picture. There's a statue, and there's a saying. It's a wild pork statue from bronze, and it's the saying in Florence: If you touch the nose of this statue, then you will come back someday to this city. And I did it with my son, and he today still has this picture. And I think we will someday come back and visit Florence again. And so it started my engagement with art and culture started after school, not in school. And even my interest in language, in the ancient language, I'm interested, and I appreciate the Latin language. It was, despite I was very good in Latin in school, but I found it really interesting. I think I started to re-engage in that language when I have been an adult with 30 years. And then I really grasped how interesting that language is. It started also at a later point of time in my life, and it was not an interest or a hobby from my early beginning, but it's never too late to start to engage with beauty, and beauty matters more than ever.
So your parents didn't bring you to any of it at all?
When I was a child, I had also some holiday travels and excursions and some castles with my parents, but not all too much. And there was no particular strive to make me especially acquainted with this. It was really, it struck me after my school life. It struck me, and I wanted to get engaged, and then I think one of my favorite epochs is the Romantic era, for example. And I think it really was something spiritual for me, because I was literally enchanted by art and beauty then, from one point in my life then. But I was already an adult.
Oh, that's amazing. It's amazing that you came. Well, you've got me into it now, and I'm 66. So there you go.
I think that's one of my greatest successes with my book, to get you into it. I'm very happy about this.
Yeah, I'm just so enthusiastic, and particularly about Katerina Koch. I want to know where I can find her poems. They blew me away. the ones you printed, and I can't find them online anyway, but I won't keep going on about that. Mark might want to speak now.
I have a lot of books in my shelves all around the distributed all around the house. My wife oftentimes has a little bit of an argument with me when I come with some more new books, where she asks where's the place? We don't have place for more books, and I have some old books and really a lot of this I have from the books and not from the internet.
Yeah, I do prefer
very
that.
very old school and traditionalist.
Well, I think there's a reason for that, because one day the internet can just switch all those books and burn them overnight, disappear them all. So I think paper copies of everything.
Censorship is the new form of book burnings in the internet nowadays.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Look, I've got another question for you, Sasha, and this one's not actually about the content of the book, but about the writing of the book, because we've done quite a few book club shows. I'm actually just going to look up what number this is of the book club. This is our 37th book review, but I believe this is the first book that we've reviewed that was written by someone whose first language wasn't English. Now, that's quite a big thing, because for you to write this book and be a, you know, obviously you're a native German, you're a German speaker, you're a German writer, but you've written this book in English. And, you know, all of us enjoyed the book. We think it's really, really good. What sort of problems did you have, if any, sort of doing the book in a language that you, that's not native to you?
That's pretty difficult. I wanted to offer an English version of the book, because it's about the Occidental world. It's not about Germany alone. So the language in the world nowadays is no more Latin, but it's English. So I wanted to have an English version of it. And I have... altogether, it is my third book. And the first book is also available in an English language. Back then, it was 2018. It was really a hard translating work. And it's easier if I'm sitting on the computer and if I'm writing. Doing the conversation with you now is much more challenging for me, because I haven't studied the language. I had English in school, and I have conversations in the political realm, and I started if books are from the English speaking world, I started reading the English versions to improve a little bit my step-by-step my language skills. But I'm not very often in my life in English speaking countries, so I don't have a permanent opportunity speaking English. So it's harder for me to do a conversation as sitting on the paper and have a time and no time pressure to think about it and how to translate. And with this book, a comrade from us, not from Germany, another comrade, did some help because he said he has a program for translating don't have the need typing. So some parts and huge parts of this book, he helped me with this technology, and I made a comparison reading. But the problem is that some parts of this book, or some particular expressions, I thought who put it on the point, and I selected in writing in the original German version, are nearly impossible to translate. There are some peculiarities in the German language that you nearly can't transfer into another language. And for example, you know, Dr. Tomislav Sunic, our common comrade there from Croatia, and he was a former diplomat, and he fluently speaks German. He always said he's a mindset German. And he read my German version of the book, and I told him that I will send him also an English version. And he has studied English. And he said, wow, he wonders if that will be possible, because I will face a lot of difficulties in translating what I have expressed in the German language. And he said that he was curious if it's possible to translate it. I think it worked out somehow properly, but it, with some expressions or some sentences on parts of the book, it was really complicated. There are words I didn't find in, I had to describe in the English style. And so it took quite a time, even the technological translated parts to, in the comparison reading German English then, to refine and to think about or to look about other words and correct it. And so it was a very busy job to do this. And afterwards, thankfully, because I was fully aware I'm not a native speaker, I didn't study the English language, and I'm not regularly used to doing conversations in the English language. So I knew I need a review reading, of course. And you knew a comrade, Mark. Thank you for this. I have sent them him also a copy of my book because I was really grateful. He, as a native speaker, did then and review and corrected some parts of the book where the how I've construed the sentences was, even if it was not wrong, but it was the syntax was typically German, and there's it's another style in how you make your sentences. There's a difference in the syntax between the English and the German language, and so I was grateful for this help. And yes, it's not easy to write if it's not your mother tongue.
The translation was in my notes, and the book, the actual text of a book is really, really well translated, and there's, you know, almost nothing you can pick up to say this wasn't written by a native English speaker. So whoever did that translation did a really good job. Some of the poetry, though, I'm consciously aware, as someone who only speaks English, that I'm probably losing some of the essence or the magic of some of the poetry. You know, Die Heimat is the first poem, which is the homeland, and the English translation is probably spot on, but I'm aware, you know, poems probably aren't meant to be translated. They're supposed to be enjoyed in the language in which they were written. So I think probably some of the poetry just suffers just by dint of the fact that it is poetry rather than, you know, spoken word or written language.
Yes, I was thinking about it, and usually I thought not to translate the German poets in the book, because it's really too difficult. You would need an outspoken expert for that.
And if you found two of them, they probably wouldn't agree on.
They wouldn't agree on. You see, if you read translations of famous literature, there are different translations, and every decade, three or four new translations, because the experts have another opinion on that. The comrade Mark recommended to me to make a review reading. He made the proposal that he could that it would be easier, what's the topic, what's the content of this poem's about, that he would translate it, and he did it. And then I said, yes, then I will put it into the book. But that's really to translate a poem is sometimes nearly impossible, and you have to be an expert, and the other problem is the time. It's everything is very time consuming, and I also have to earn a living beyond writing books. But it can be interesting. I'm a huge, huge fan of Goethe, for example, and I love his famous work, Goethe's Faust. And maybe some of you can give me a recommendation, not now or afterwards, the next days. I was thinking, because I was reading Goethe's Faust very often, and I was reading expert literature about Goethe's Faust. But now the idea came to my mind, if I could learn much more about it, if I would try to read an English translation of Goethe's Faust, because I could then ruminate about the thoughts. Why did the translator translate it this way or not another way? And engaging in a book in two languages in this, I can imagine that you, the message or the spirit of the book, you learn much more and can delve much deeper into the topic. But maybe someone can in the next weeks recommend me who is or was the best English translator for Goethe's Faust, that I have a recommendation which book I should order to try to read it for the first time in my life in an English translation. And I can imagine that would be a very interesting experience in literature.
Okay, yeah, thank you for that. I'll pass it back if Sal or Mark wants to jump in.
Yes, we'll keep going around the group. Sally, you go next.
Well, what I was actually going to say, very similar to what Natty just said about the translation of the poetry, because I can appreciate how difficult it is. But personally, I found the poems just so wonderful that I wouldn't notice. I wouldn't know. The English people that read these poems don't know what they sound or what they mean in German. They don't know what the author in. They just know what's presented to them in English, and to me, somebody reading them for the first time, I found them just absolutely moving and brilliant, and wanted to read more. And what else amazed me is whoever translated Katharina Cox's poems, because they rhyme, managed to do it and make them rhyme in English. I just thought that's an amazing feat to be able to do that. Just whoever translated it, is it the same man?
The one who translated it. Am I right, Mark, that the comrade for reviewing you recommended me speaks very, very fluently German as well?
No.
Not? Because
no, the person, then, I'm not going to give his name out, but the person who...
Then maybe he knows someone or who helped him or he found some translations in...
Yeah, I think he did.
I don't know. I mean, I recommended it. I don't really want to talk about this on screen because I'll end up sort of giving away things, but
yeah, no, I can see.
I can't remember the exact
process. I remember on the conference October 2024, when I was at your PA conference, I met one guy, and I didn't know if he was it. I met one guy who was for many years living in Munich and who was speaking very, very good German. And I thought if he maybe was it or they had contact with one together, maybe. I don't know.
No, I think the Katharina Cox poem probably had already been translated into English because it says edited by Carl Franz Joseph Weiss. So I think it had already probably been translated into English when you published it. I don't think it needed translating.
Yeah.
I've just found it amazing that they managed to make it rhyme as well and still make it really... They blew me away, her poems. I just love them.
I think the book is in general, it's interesting for the British people because it's about the whole Euro-Occidental heritage and many, and I've touched many artists from numerous countries. But when I do a look to the book, there is there's really a huge part of the British world. There's I think after Germany and Britain have the most parts in the book, I think.
I did spend an awful lot of time on Google reading about Lord Byron and his just probably 4 hours on him. And the same with Waterhouse. I can't remember now which one. Is it Waterhouse? Was he an artist? Yeah, he was, wasn't he? Looking at his paintings. I've just spent so much time on the internet, more time on the internet than I ever have reading a book, because it was just, like I said, 4 hours later, I pick up the book again. And I really
my incentive to motivate engaging in culture and arts worked out well. If it works out well with every reader, that would be excellent.
Hopefully people will get the book and see what I'm talking about. I'll give it back to you, Mark.
Well, I wanted to ask another question because I enjoyed the book, and I enjoyed the book because I found it to be interesting in the fact that when I was reading the prologue, the book sort of lays out that this isn't meant to be an exhaustive take. It's just personal opinions, but from a nationalist perspective. And it's kind of one man's take on art and how he believes art influenced the world, but also how art influences him. And I found that very interesting. But one thing I wondered about, Sasha, now I know it's only a very slim book, so I'm actually holding it in my hand now. And compared to some of the books we've read on Book Club, like David Duke's My Awakening, you know, you could probably get like three or four of these into My Awakening. You know, it's a very slim book. I think it doesn't even run to 200 pages. When you take out sort of the prologue and the about the author at the end, it's about 150 pages. It's a very brief read. Now, at certain points during the book, and I'm not saying it's bad for being brief, but I wondered, because at certain points during the book, you only have to flick through, and you do utilize quite a lot of pictures, which I actually like, because when you're discussing art, you quote a lot of poetry, but when you're discussing art or architecture, it is nice to see what you're talking about. And I wondered if you ever thought about potentially publishing a longer version that was maybe hardback, much thicker, and you actually did sort of use higher quality, maybe colour pictures within the book. I'm not saying turning it into a picture book, but when I have read books that critique art or architecture in the past, usually the pictures are far more numerous and much higher resolution, full colour. And I think it would be quite interesting to read sort of a thicker volume of this, but with more emphasis on actual photos or reproductions of the art that inspired you. I don't know whether you thought about that or whether you have thought about that, because it is an enjoyable book, but it would have been interesting to see more examples throughout and to see the examples sort of in higher resolution and in colour, because it paints such a vivid picture, obviously, of what you're talking about. And sometimes when I was reading this, not always, but sometimes, you know, for more context, you sort of Google an artist or a particular picture, or there's a black and white picture, and it's nice to see it in colour. I didn't know whether you sort of thought about this and have ever thought, well, maybe if this sells well, we could do sort of a revised edition with more images and with more of a focus on actually viewing the art and the architecture that specifically inspired you.
Yes, of course, I was thinking about it. And there are two aspects why it is how it is now. One aspect was that I wanted to make it in a manageable volume, due to the experience and the experience a lot of comrades in the publishing scenery told me that people are not reading, don't have the reading behavior as it was 30 or 40 years ago today. And the other aspect was, it's, yeah, the, the time consuming aspect and the aspect of investment, how much I would have to invest in the forefield for the pictures or for buying the pictures, because the graphic design and everything else. So there had been some impediments what I was able to do, and that led to the decision that it worked out in that way with this volume. The thought is interesting to do it, and especially in there are a chapter about the art in the Third Reich, for example. It's a topic which usually nobody is informed about it, and nowhere you can hear or see it, or you learn anything about it. They act like there hadn't been any cultural life in that during that time, which is not true. And I have some catalogues from the galleries from this time and the huge events and so on. I would have had much more pictures and very excellent works from this time, but it was also a question of investment and money. And warnings of some comrades and some friends who said it's risky to writing about this topic, because if in nowadays decadent times with such a niche topic, if you will find reader for this, so some people warned me, be careful with that book, because it's a niche topic. You don't know if somebody today is interested in it, and if you can get the people with this topic. So that's the honest cause why it worked out this way.
Yeah, what I was going to say, I'm not a fan of ebooks at all, but what I wondered was, wouldn't it be great if it was an ebook with hyperlinks to all the art and all the poetry, or all the works of all the poets, or even if you couldn't do it that way, to do it with like QR codes in the book that you could just scan your phone on.
You mean writing more and more extensive with the poets and then these examples?
No. Instead of putting your photographs in the book, just put a QR code which led the reader could scan and then see the whole collection of art.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's just something I thought of afterwards. It's not a big deal to go on Google and look up the artwork. So,
Indeed, I have plans for some more books. The next book will be a typical political book. But for the future, I have also some ideas to touch the cultural sphere and. I'm also thinking about writing a book solely focused on literature in the future. Maybe we can make some before I start some brainstorming in that regard. I'm always of course I'm always thankful for good proposals, recommendations, and ideas. It will not be my last book, hopefully. I'm planning to write more.
I hope you do. Natty, we'll throw it over to you, mate.
Yeah, I kind of want to delve into your thoughts on some of the periods and the art that you talk about. The subtext of the book is it's important now, and I had this impression when you were talking at the start, is that... it's important now because we've been severed from our culture and our history and things that probably people would be made aware of and would be enjoying and being aware of their own art and their history and who they are kind of being taken away from us and severed from who we are. The obvious breaking point is the Second World War. But is there one of the periods you've touched on where you think this idea of artistic expression as like a reflection of a people and a culture, where there's a break from that, maybe Impressionism or or surrealism or something like that that you really think is like a break point or is exemplary of something that went wrong somewhere?
Yes, I think that my personal opinion or my personal taste is there are still some good works in Impressionism and in Surrealism, but maybe in literature also in Expressionism in painting. I'm not a friend from the time of Expressionism ongoing, and the abstract art and post modern art to put rubbish together or
sell a tape of banana to a wall,
put a banana on the wall. I refuse to categorize this into the sphere of art. That's more or less a psychological expression of a psychological a problem or a distortion. Because I think I have written it already into the preface of the book that art and culture is always a mirror of the zeitgeist, or sometimes a magnifying glass of the zeitgeist, and so it not always blossoms, but there you see also the absurdities. But I think it's to our distinctive characteristic nature, and it's about our self-conception. And regarding the testimonies of our culture, and I think that's very important to talk about this today due to the distorted self-image by, for example, the Netflix productions, the decadent tititainment, or the post-modernist value relativistic education system. And so I think it's important to talk about beauty not as a marketing article, but to talk about beauty as a philosophical entity, that to show that beautiful art has something soothing, that that it's a thrill of pleasure, a mysterious joy, to look for the perception of meaning behind it. And if you are amazed by something, you can also as an adult feel like a child because you can marvel in awe. And that's maybe the feeling Dostoevsky said, beauty will save the world. And in this pits of hell, in this barbarous hellsink of vice, represented by the Epstein elite and this all those postmodernist protagonists, I think to talk with Nietzsche, a peak of ravishment instead of ecstatic decadence is very important. And who, if not we nationalists, we identitarian, should talk about this? And that's why I think it was this book can be important or can be interesting in the decadent sickness of our era for our comrades.
Just leading on from that, one of the thoughts I had as I was reading this was that as the periods you talk about, the art that it produces is kind of a reflection of the culture and the people and the zeitgeist and the elites, which we could talk about as well. In my opinion, European people are defeated and subjugated as a whole. Now, that's not to say that we're not still capable of, you know, love and goodness and kindness and self-expression. But we've been led to believe we're not a defeated people and we're not being subjugated, whereas I believe we are. And if we were to accept that, do you think it would produce a different kind of art than we have at the moment, rather than this kind of trash culture, that we could embrace the fact that we are currently not in a good place and not heading anywhere good?
Well, I think so. I had a post on my Telegram channel a week or 2 weeks ago, not long ago, based on an article I found, an article I think some years ago, and that was an article about how the CIA in the war between the systems with the Soviet Union and the United States, how the CIA promoted the modern art. And if you look at the business, the art business today, it lives from subsidies. They promote that rubbish, like sticking a banana on the wall. There's no relation. It's a small self-proclaimed elitist decadence circle who circles around it postmodern art based on subsidies. I think if you would have not such a distorted a competition, but a real competition that beauty could break through, and maybe the engagement with art, hopefully my book will incite some to this, will also widen our range of political activity, that maybe we can, in our organizations, we can incite the creative people within our ranks to start making art by themselves, to make some competitions in poetry, or make some additionally to an event an exhibition of some pictures, or if someone who are musicians who play parts from an opera which never has been published because he was famous in a special era or anything else. And I think that that would be a part of organic and organizational diversity, which could maybe help also approach a certain target, new target group for our political purpose. And I would love to see becoming active artistic expressions of work from our lads as a part of our movement. And maybe if some who are very creative or very talented in, be it in painting or be it in music or whatever, who become acquainted with my book, maybe a few will start and make the first steps in that way. For example, in the political party I represent, called Die Heimat, as much as the homeland, there is a section within our part. It's called Heimatkulturwerk. It's homeland. Dot culture dot and work. In this context, it's hard to translate. So we have a section in our party who makes organizes events and does networking with young political artists. I find this very interesting, and I'm excited about seeing which development this will take.
Okay, thank you. Just a follow-up, if no one else wants to expand on that. Is there anything that you see, I don't think you've written about it in the book, at least if you did, I missed it, but currently anything mainstream or any expression of art that you would recommend that's fairly modern, that people could look at as an example, a good example of the things you list in the book from earlier periods?
Yes, I have some from contemporary. It was also, for example, if you in painting, there are some contemporary painters today. For example, Volegov, a Russian painter, which is really excellent painter. Or there are in I have some in regarding the music. I have maybe let me have a short look. I think there is something I have recommended in my book some of this. Yes, it's right. I see it. Volegov, Mashenikov also, and Gerhardt, Daniel Gerhardt is an American, or Stephen Hanks, an American. Excellent contemporary painters. And I had also recommended in literature some interesting books. And regarding the music, for example, there is I think she is very, very often in Britain. She's a Montenegrin, a British Montenegrin soprano, Tamara Radjanovic, a young woman. She is absolutely fantastic. It's if you see her, you think there is a goddess came from the heavens, and she could probably sing from a telephone directory and better than many others. I have in the end of my book, I have some contemporary artists I can recommend which to admire. So still today, there are some who are connected with the techniques of the old masters and present artworks of outstanding beauty. It's fortunately, it's not just the postmodern rubbish.
And just to cap off before anyone jumps in, do you see, this is slightly a broader question, but do you see just postmodernism just continuing into the future until we have a change of leadership in Europe or a change of circumstances in Europe? Or do you think anything else will emerge, or will it just get worse? Is it just a worse version of postmodernism?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. But however, if you observe the huge events presented by the mainstream media, there is reason to fear that it will become worse. But I don't have a crystal ball. Often, shortly before dawn, there is the darkest hour of the night, so I don't know. And there's also another aspect. To what degree the art will be entered also by AI, by artificial intelligence. So it's hard to say. I want to be careful to give a prognosis there, but maybe it will become worse until it will become better. Maybe it never will become better, because art depends on the carrier, or culture depends on the carrier of culture. And I'm not sure if we see that more and more pressing social and economic problems, more and more that elbow society with inhomogeneous transformation in demography. I'm not sure if in such an environment, if this is the good the suitable floor that art will flourish. So Sorry, I don't know, and I don't dare to give a prognosis with conviction. That's how it will be. I really don't know. I just hope that there will be some artists, some upcoming artists who will have that sense of beauty, which is needed to be that beauty which will save the world, according to Dostoevsky.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Thank you. Thank you for answering that.
Yeah, I just want to say I saw where you mentioned about the artist you just named, and I did Google them, and yeah, they absolutely blew me away. They were outstanding. I did think at the time, AI, what about AI? What's that? Where's that going to take everyone? But one of the things I wanted to say was, we've had all these periods in history, like the Romanesque, the Gothic, the Renaissance, Baroque, Classicism, Romantics, and whatever. And like now, we've got postmodernism, which is awful. And like in 100 years' time, what will they call it? Because postmodernism it doesn't even sound nice compared to the others. They sound kind of really nice, Baroque. Gothic is kind of nice, but also in a way those art forms were kind of, with some of the artists, they were a rebellion against the system that they saw, or the things they didn't like about the way that it was going, and we haven't got that now. I don't see any the rebellion to me seemed to be to go through pop music, from I'm going back to the 70s when it was when pop punk rock started coming in and stuff, and so the rebellion was taken into music, and that was all controlled anyway. I just wonder what you thought about that, about the art, like the rebellion has been within art, and all the great poets, they were all kind of rebels, weren't they? And it's all been stifled. It's just very sad.
According to me, I would. My hope is that, how will they call it in 100 years, that postmodernist rubbish? If it was on me, I would. It would be a pathological diagnosis, and not any longer a term of the art sector.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah, that's good. Consign it to the dustbin of history.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, that, I was sort of thinking nihilistic narcissism or something, but I don't know.
The Jewish period.
Yeah.
So, during the book, you spoke briefly about art during the fascist period and also during the Third Reich, and you also spoke about art during the Roman era. I've always wondered where art would have gone, say the Second World War had ended differently, say Britain had sort of sued for peace, or the Germans had managed to capture everyone at Dunkirk and that had been the end of it, and over a period of time Germany had then worn down Russia because they weren't fighting against Britain and America at the same time. Obviously, there would have been no North Africa campaign. Oil would have flown from North Africa to help the Germans. There wouldn't have been issues that would have affected supply lines. And there would have been a change in the way art was produced and appraised under a different sort of, what do you call it, political and social system that would have come about if the outcome of World War II had been different. I don't know if you've thought about this much, Sasha, or if you can even talk about it. And if you can't, I wouldn't be offended, because obviously I don't want to get you into any trouble. But it's quite interesting, really, from looking at the book. Where do you think art would have gone if the Second World War had turned out differently? And also, what similarities do you kind of see between Greco-Roman art and the kind of art that was idealized under the Third Reich and fascist regimes?
It's a very, very interesting question. And it would have been very, very much more interesting even if we would have had the chance to experience that. I think, first of all, one has to know that during the Third Reich in Germany, there was not such a thing that one homogeneous string or only one line or one direction of a political coordinated art, how it has to be. And within the NSDAP and the leadership, even up to the leadership in the NSDAP, there had been hard discussions and very, very different opinions about art. And by far they haven't been very there haven't been a consensus in that. So for example, Adolf Hitler didn't like expressionism at all in the painting, and a lot of these pictures were called the entartete Kunst. Otherwise, Goebbels, for example, was much more a modernist in that kind. And there have been different styles. And interestingly, for example, in Germany during the Third Reich, in painting, most of the artists focused on that genre painting, relied on that rural style. Otherwise, if you look in Italy, the fascist Italy, and if you look in painting, it was not from this rural perspective. On the contrary, it was more on the towns, the cities, and they had more a futuristic style. Otherwise, in music, they wanted in Italy they wanted to base it more on in back to the antique. So there was really a high dynamic that and so your question is very interesting. It would have been interesting where that would have been led, and then there was some, I take now the term, really some diversity, and that was and within the leadership, by far they didn't have all the same taste or a consensus on what is good or odd or on what is not a good art. And regarding literature, I during the last 20 years or more, I have searched and I've bought a lot of books you're hard to get today, and there are different styles in which these books are written. So, which is told that there is only one dump style coordinated by the political leadership. Absolute bullshit. That's not true. And unfortunately, we don't know where it would have been developed, because most of those artists after 1945 hadn't any chance to make a career, or most of them were career ended or worse. But it's very interesting to do a research regarding that sector, and if you research in that sector, you find some surprises which differ from what is told you in the education system.
Natty, over to you, mate.
Well, my next question's much lighter in its tone than the one you just answered. And I don't know. You don't have to answer this if you don't want to, but I was going to ask what your thoughts on memes were and meme culture that's arisen in the last 5 or 10 years. Do you think that reflects anything about us and where we are?
The memes in the social media sphere or
it used to be just internet culture, but increasingly it's just used by everyone. You know, memes are just used by everyone to communicate ideas and jokes, I guess, visual.
Yes,
jokes.
Of course, it's also a part of culture, maybe subculture partly. But it is it's a part of culture as, for example, you can compare it with a comic. It's also a part of culture or of a part of artwork. And as in every artwork, there is good art and there is bad art. It's a kind of due to the technological affiliation and the nowadays communication platforms. It's a kind of art which has more reach. But I think the huge difference is that not only that it's more politicized, and the classical art is more about not politicized aesthetics. I think another difference is that this kind of modern art, like memes, it's very it's a short living. It's a kind. It's something. It's art which is consumed. And that's a difference to the classic form of art. The classic form of art is you are in our artworks the intensity of if you consider the classical art there, and you look at the artwork or look at the original physically in a gallery, the intensity of the inspection makes the moment vanishing or makes the moment more eternal. It's a combination of feelings from beauty and delight, and you can stand half an hour or longer and stare and delve into that artwork. I think that's a different to these modern expressions used in the political internet sphere with the memes. I didn't think a lot. I didn't think about that subject up to now. You with this question, you reached me a little bit unprepared. So
I'm quite glad.
It's my first thought on that subject.
I want to kind of push back a bit because memes. I mean, you say that you could spend hours, for instance, looking at the front facade of the Breslau, the town hall in Breslau, or a Constable painting. They're designed to convey an idea. You know, a Constable painting is designed to convey this, the beauty of the English countryside, for instance, and you could admire it. Or the town hall in Breslau, a municipal building that's had a lot of thought put into its architecture is designed to convey the idea of power and central organization, and this is where our leaders and this is where the people who organize us are. But memes as propaganda have been used to change people's minds about political ideas, in some cases probably quite effectively. I mean, I am not so egotistical to think that I haven't seen memes which have swayed me on political ideas. You know, I've seen something that initially has just seemed funny that has buried an idea like deep in my brain that stuck with me for days afterwards. So I appreciate that. I've maybe caught you off guard a little bit with the question, but I think maybe you as an enjoyer of art would maybe just take time to consider that memes could be or should be quite important method of communication, and maybe lowbrow, but art nonetheless.
Of course, they are important. They are highly effective regarding a high reach, without doubt.
Yeah. Okay. Well. Thank you very much. I'll pass it on.
Sally?
I think the thing about memes, and I do like a good meme, but they don't require an attention span. And that's the problem with the society at the moment, especially the youth. But even the boomers. It's the attention span of people, how long they're prepared to invest in looking at something and giving it their time. And you know, with the arts, I think that's why the youth really just aren't really, in general, they're just not interested in the arts at all. I think it'll be hard to get them to appreciate the sort of things in the book. But then it would start with their parents. So it would start with people your age, Natty and Mark, to install it in your children to get the appreciation there. Because the current crop of kids are just, it's all, they're like, they've got the attention span of a goldfish. They just, they're literally on memes. They're, you know, they get it from the memes. So, yeah, I get your point, Natty, but I get Sasha's point. I mean, if you don't know your culture, I mean, the purpose of the book, I mean, I've written it down, that's right at the beginning. The purpose of the book was to,
That's okay, Sal. I'm not gonna label the point.
The book is to trace the development of our Occidental culture. So you know, and that's the point, that it's our children just. They're seeing their history on TV, and they're taking it all on the internet or wherever, Netflix, and they're just not seeing the real history. And someone's got to keep it alive, and it's going to be the older generation, people like Sasha, that write books like these that keep it going, and the parents of the next generation of European children across the world that keep these arts going or keep these arts in the minds of our children and grandchildren as well. That's on you, Natty and Mark.
Well, I think I am the youngest person here, so if there's one person who's going to be defending stupid memes on the internet, I guess it's going to be me.
Yeah, but I love a meme. I just think it. I love a meme. I mean, the memes, especially because they're so funny. I love them.
I guess my point is that even high art, even the great classical pieces and pieces of architecture, convey ideas very quickly. You can spend half an hour, days pondering some wonderful piece of architecture, but quite often your subconscious is taking in the meaning of something like that very quickly, whether it's a ornate facade or a cathedral or a painting that kind of stirs some emotion in you, in the same way that I guess memes have capitalized attention spans, but can be long lasting.
Maybe a spontaneous thought now. Maybe it would be an idea for the meme content creators, or we will call this community, to think about if they can connect.
Integrate. Yes.
Yes. Yes. Integrate. Yes. Yeah, yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You had it. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
No, it's a good thought. So, you know, maybe the youngsters in the audience can have a think about that, maybe. Who knows? I'll pass it back, though. I've sidetracked the book a little bit here.
Well, I wanted to ask a couple more questions about things that you touched on in the book. And there's so much that you could have spoken about, because you didn't just sort of focus in on one thing. I think if I focused in on something that really inspires me, I would have gone for architecture, because I love going around Britain and looking at the architecture. And I know this sounds a bit sort of cheesy, but I take as much from a cathedral like York Minster as I do from a sleepy little village of traditionally constructed cottages with thatched roofs. I find it all quite inspiring, but you covered a wide number of topics. And at one point you mentioned Tolkien, and I often hear nationalists talk about Tolkien, Lord of the Rings, The Hobbit, but specifically Lord of the Rings and the incredibly deep lore surrounding that world that he created. What sort of inspiration has Tolkien been on your work? And also, I do see many nationalists like to create an analogy between the conflict in The Lord of the Rings and what we face today. Do you follow that? Is that something that's inspired you?
My interest in Tolkien is the admiration. He was a genius in languages, and Tolkien is in our household a person because as long as our son was living at home, now he is his own home with his girlfriend, he is a lover of Tolkien, and he extensively read Tolkien, and still today we often discuss or talk about Tolkien. And I love a Tolkien because he delves in mythology, in the mythology of different folks. And he was, what I admire is he was such a genius in languages, not because he even created artificial languages for his literature, because he was speaking Latin fluently. He was speaking ancient Greek fluently. Everyone who had Latin in school or ancient Greek in school knows that these are very, very grammatically complex languages, which is the reason why there arose a lot of good philosophy, because it's language and complexity of grammar correlates with complexity of thinking and awareness and consciousness. And in school you don't learn these ancient languages the same way didactically as you learn modern languages. So you learn to translate, but nearly nobody is able, even after 5 or 6 years having had ancient Greek or Latin in school, to speak. Even teachers often can't speak those languages fluently. But for example, the young Tolkien, as a pupil, when they had a theater play in school, he played two roles, the three roles he had in one theater. I've read it about in a biography about him. Three different roles. One was an old Gothic, one a Roman soldier, and one an Greek, I don't know, slave or anything else. And he was able to speak all those three languages fluently already as a pupil. And he delved deep into the soul of our European folks by knowing those languages as he could speak his daily English, or also his skills in the old and middle English languages. And so Tolkien's brain embraced somehow in an abstract way the whole cultural knowledge of his folks, or the British, by having made the language in the including the whole genesis of the language to his own. And I think knowing this linguistic background, this mirrors somehow in his literature and in his works, and he's such an admirable intellectual brain, so he had to take his place of honor then in my book. He's one of the greatest minds.
Natty?
I've noticed this. In fact, we had a gentleman staying with my parents recently who was from Holland, and his English wasn't the best, though he could speak English, but he had books with him and a lot of Tolkien books. You know, he had all the Lord of Rings and the Silmarillion and everything else. So I think Tolkien, as an Englishman, he obviously pulled something deep from the kind of not just the English psyche, but the European psyche. And I think that's probably why he's so loved and why as a people who are on the decline, people who understand that that decline is real and happening, look to Tolkien and look to his works as kind of almost historical. I mean, it's not historical, but it feels historical. And I think that's one of the strengths of his work, right? I mean, you probably would agree with that. I think probably Mark and Sasha would probably agree with that. And most of the people listening, is that one of the reasons that Tolkien resonates so well. And I think even Peter Jackson in his adaptations in the film managed to capture this as well, that it feels like European history and not just English history. You know, the Shire is kind of tracks as English, but Rohan is kind of this strange mix of Norse and Swedish and, you know, kind of Eastern European warrior culture. So I think that's why he's so popular, and that's why it always gets brought up as a topic of conversation and when people talk about history and culture and art and literature.
You put it great. Precisely. I agree to 100%, Natty.
Sal, have you got anything to add on Tolkien?
No, I'm a peasant. I've not read any of it.
Oh, no.
I really haven't. I really haven't. Not even Lord of the Rings. I haven't even watched the film. I'm just so busy. I just don't. I'm
the next book review is going to be the full Lord of the Rings trilogy. And
do you know what? I wouldn't mind. Oh, if it was part of this, I wouldn't. Well, you wouldn't get the author on. But I wouldn't mind because. I haven't read it, and there's an awful lot of the books that are recommended within nationalism that I haven't seen, but I kind of get the gist of them. So, and I should read them. I know I should, but I'm busy. I'm reading other things that are more fun. So, sorry about that.
Well, I'll kick this question back then to either Mark or Sasha. Is there any? Are there any contemporary kind of fantasy writers do you think have hit that kind of historical nerve in the same way that Tolkien has? I know it's probably putting you on the spot a bit. George R. R. Martin, Game of Thrones is the Plantagenet kind of scene with the kings of Game of Thrones, kings and queens maneuvering and all of that stuff. But it doesn't hit quite the same way as Tolkien, right?
My son would be able to answer that question. I think he has books from three or four other authors who goes toward that direction, but I haven't read it and I don't know the names right now. So I unfortunately can't answer that question. But I would be happy to experience that this style of literature would become popular, especially within the younger generations. That would be a hopeful development.
Fair enough. Okay, I'll pass it back.
The best piece that I've ever read that comes sort of in the same sort of category as Lord of the Rings in terms of its absolutely epic sort of size and scale is a manga. It's called Berserk, and I've got to say I actually enjoyed Berserk more than I enjoyed Lord of the Rings, and people scoff at that and be like, how could you enjoy anything more than Lord of the Rings? I enjoyed Berserk more than Lord of the Rings, because Lord of the Rings, without being too critical of it, I felt didn't have the best character work. It had the best, like, big picture world building, sort of believable fantasy world, but it never truly zoomed in to a great degree on the sort of trials and tribulations and pain of the main protagonists. Whereas Berserk, if you read that from the beginning, that is not only sort of set in a world of the same kind of size and scale, it starts off as a very small world with groups of mercenaries fighting each other, and they're then drawn into a bigger conflict, which ends up having sort of world-changing effects. But Berserk is just so good because it not only has this incredible wider narrative and larger world, but it has, because it starts off so zoomed in at the level of individual soldiers who you learn to love over a period of time, the betrayals and the twists are so much more emotionally impactful. It's so much more adult, but also what starts off as kind of a, we're soldiers, we're mercenaries, we're fighting in these human wars, ends up having this darker twist after what's called, it's done in sagas. And the first, although canonically it's released, the first saga that to be released is called The Black Swordsman, but that's not actually the first that takes place in the actual story. Sorry, I should say it was, the first to be released was The Black Swordsman, but that canonically takes place after the Golden Age. And if you read it from the first bit of the Golden Age, the first chapter of the Golden Age, in order, it's the best thing I've ever read. And not only is it the best thing I've ever read, but when I found out that the original creator died before finishing it, and it's being finished currently by his best friend who knew what the ending is, but it'll never be finished by the man who started it. It makes it like the most gutting thing ever, because it truly is my sort of favorite story based in kind of a high fantasy world. And I recommend everyone reads it. But not only do I recommend everyone reads it, there is a free version of it on YouTube set to music in 4K. So if you've got a really good phone, like a Samsung Galaxy Ultra or something like that, and you're sat in bed and you're watching it, it will play on your phone rather than having to turn the pages. It will play on your phone, zooming in at the right points of the images, the right points of the artwork. And the artwork is set to music which matches the tempo of what's going on, making it probably one of the most immersive experiences I've ever enjoyed. And I know people will scoff at it because it's like Japanese and it's a manga, but I can honestly say, somebody said to me, read Berserk, you won't be disappointed. And I was like, go on then, I'll give it a go. And I was not disappointed. And anyone that wants to read it, send me an email. I will send you a link or mention it in the comments, and I'll put in the comments where to watch it for free. It's absolutely brilliant. And not only is it brilliant, but there's lots of things that are analogous of sort of real world events. So the author is obviously or was very well read in real world events. And there's an incredible part of the storyline where what are clearly like Muslim invaders take over what is a fantasy European land, just like the Moorish invasion of Spain, and then it has to be reconquered. It's absolutely fantastic. I know, Natty, you're going to scoff at this, but trust me, it's worth reading.
I'm just sitting here shaking my head. Mark, the Japanese weeb enjoyer. I'm never touching it because it was just Japanese. It's not my. Maybe I'll give it a try. You've got one gentleman in chat who's absolutely on your side. He says it's insanely good and we have to read it.
It is, honestly, I never thought something could be this good until I watched it. And I, as I said, I watched it on YouTube, set to music, which makes it even better. It's not as good when you just read it, but set to the music. And they've set it to music from things like Witcher 3 and other things that you would know. So Witcher 3, Dark Souls.
Here's a real test of whether you've sold this. Sasha, would you consider, and you can be brutally honest about this, are you gonna check out Berserk, the Japanese manga?
I would give it a chance to read it because the description of Mark was very, very interesting. And shortly to add that the Silmarillion, the main opus of Tolkien, it as well wasn't finished. He died, and his son Christian Tolkien finished the Silmarillion.
There you go. You got an endorsement, Mark. I think you've sold it. Whether I'm going to check it out, that remains to be
seen.
Mate,
if you don't check it out, I'm going to put you in a headlock and force you to watch it.
Okay. Well, that you've run me out of questions. So that was my last question was actually about anime, and we've kind of touched on it. So.
Sally, do you have any more questions? Because we're going to wrap things up in about 5 minutes. We'll do the super chats and then we'll wrap things up. Sally, do you have any last question?
No, I haven't got any questions, but I just for the audience, I want to read out. I want to talk about the conclusions because they were excellent. There was one of in the conclusions, the last part. I just want to read a quote from a paragraph rather than go too long. But he said, "It is about correctly understanding the meaning of legacies, which is by no means to be consumed, but rather to germinate again and again." And I just thought that's what the essence of the arts is. It's to germinate again and again. It just really hit me, so I wanted to share that with everybody. But no, carry on with your super chats.
I actually thought that, because when I read that, I realised that the strength of what Sasha was pointing out, the pieces he talks about, is that they resonate through the ages. They're not just for a people at a certain time. They're for a people, you know, a certain people, but throughout time. So I thought that was a really good way of putting that.
Yeah, so did I. Yeah, that's why I wanted to mention it, and I'm glad I did. But right, we'll let you get on, Mark.
Right, we'll do the super chats. Thank you to everyone who super chatted. There's been some generous super chats tonight, and I truly appreciate that. Draven J gave $50 and said enjoying this one. Well, thank you for your continued support. You've been extremely generous, and I truly, truly appreciate it. Theseus Labyrinth gave $10. Thank you so much. He said, no link whatsoever to the topic, other than the author is German. Does Sasha know W.G. Sebald? He was German and wrote beautifully, blending history with imagination. He lived in Norfolk and died young. Are you aware of his work, Sasha?
I heard the name, but I didn't read the work. Unfortunately, I didn't read yet. As I said during the show, I'm still alive, and there are a lot of things to watch, and hopefully a lot of things to read. And I right now learned that this, of course, will be a top recommendation.
Okay, thank you. And Theseus Labyrinth gave another $10. Thank you so much. And he said, when the revolution comes, Latin will be reinstated as a mandatory school subject. Just a quick question here, because I'm 45. Natty, I think you're about 37, 38?
38.
Yeah. It's weird, isn't it? Because you're quite a bit younger than me, but you still aren't as quick with like the mouse and keyboard.
Shut up.
It's just got, you know, he's got the youth, but he hasn't got the motor skills. It's like I am literally the old swordsman that outdoes the young pup every time we game together. It's pretty embarrassing, to be honest, Natty, if we're gonna
Mark,
get him in a boat, Natty, get him in a boat and see how he does.
When I beat Natty in the boat, then he'll truly cry. I'm not going on the water with him because I can't take away the man's only thing. I couldn't do that to him, Sally.
Mark, I would have one question. How is it in Britain with the schools? Are there Latin schools, or how is...
Well, this is what I was going to ask everybody, because when I was at school, I'm 45, so I'm sort of in the middle here. Latin was a compulsory subject at the beginning of my secondary education. So when I went through the 11 plus, Latin was a compulsory subject up until GCSE, where you could choose to sort of, you got to choose then your subjects. And I dropped Latin and did art. Natty, was Latin a subject at your school?
No, it was not, no.
I'm follower of a Telegram channel who is in Latin. It's an Italian Latin teacher who makes YouTube videos and lessons teaching Latin like a modern language, to speak a Latin. And there exists a Telegram channel. It's called Satura Lanx, and I'm follower of that Latin Telegram channel. I like that language.
I mean, I learned Latin. I did learn Latin at school.
Was it a compulsory?
Yes. Yeah. I think I did it. I dropped it. But not because I didn't like it, but because I couldn't see it back then. I couldn't see the point of it. And I used to go to school in Westminster, and some of it, you know, a bit of walking through Westminster. And I would go around writing down all the inscriptions on certain monuments. There's inscriptions all over London. And then take them to school and translate them in the library. And I was quite shocked at how evil some of the things that are said on the walls that you walk past every day. So that sort of piqued my interest in it. And it became a thing for me to sort of go around deliberately reading these Latin inscriptions everywhere and translate them. And it's quite shocking. But I got to an age and I thought, well, I did French. And then I thought, well, it's not a language that's ever going to help me. It helped me in some ways. But it's not going to help me in my life. And I'd rather do Spanish, which at least I can speak. So sort of I went on later on to do Spanish. But I regret that now, to be honest. But where would it have got me? I'm not a literary person. I've not gone into that. I didn't go into that field. So, it wasn't worth studying when you already have enough to study, if you know what I mean. But I don't know if it's, I don't think my grandchildren, I don't think they, I'm pretty sure it's not at their school. Pretty sure.
I always wondered, when so much was written in Latin, especially by the church, how it sort of became a dead language. It sort of interested me, that did, because you would imagine that the power the church had and the fact the church performed services in Latin and most of its teachings were taught and written in Latin. I'll have to look this up, but I always found it was weird that it kind of dropped out of that kind of mainstream and became a dead language. But it is quite interesting.
I'll tell you what I didn't like about it was that the way they teach it to you and the way that an English person speaks it, you know it's not authentic because nobody knows how it's pronounced by the people at the time. By the Romans at the time, yeah, and it sounds stupid, when people.
I disagree.
I'll give you an example. Years ago, I was young. I dated a bodybuilder, and we went to see Arnold Schwarzenegger's Pumping Iron, and there was a B movie to it that I didn't know, and I think it was Sebastian, and it was in this language, and I'm thinking, what language is that? I didn't realise it was a gay. Not quite porno, but pretty bad. It was just why it was put next to Arnold Schwarzenegger's Pumping Iron, I don't know. But it was all in Latin. So I'm reading it, I think, because it was, I don't know if there were, no, there weren't English subtitles. But I was able to recognise, but again, they didn't sound authentic. So why do you think it sounds authentic when it's spoken? Maybe it sounds better when a German says a Latin phrase. But when the English people say it, or maybe, to me, it just doesn't sound like a language. It sounds awful.
I can now.
Maybe you didn't hear someone who speaks really good and fluent Latin. If you hear a fluent good Latin speaker, or for example, if such a good Latin speaker reads you the speeches, the original Roman speeches that can have a very toxic masculine sound. And I have didactical books Latin teachers made to teach it like a modern language, or in YouTube and internet you find some pages where Latin is spoken. And if you listen that of a good speaker, then it has a really impressive sound. And and if you engage in the very, very, indeed, very, very complicated, the not the prose, the poems, the poetry, the Latin poetry, and the with the with all this the metrical things, then that's really highly appreciable intellectual kind of art. And maybe a little bit funny to hear, in my bookshelves I also have a Latin version of Tolkien's The Hobbit, and I have a Latin version of the novel The Parfum, Fragrantia, and I even have some modern literature which is written in Latin. And that's really, if you engage in it's really interesting.
Oh, that is interesting. I mean, I've forgotten it that much. I had to look up Carpe Diem. Every time I see it, I have to look it up. So that's how much I've forgotten it, which is a shame.
I will send to Mark one or two links with fluently spoken Latin. He can send it to you then, and then you can hear how, according to my opinion, good spoken Latin sounds.
Oh, that would be nice. Yeah, great.
Of course.
Also, just to clarify this, Latin didn't actually die out. I've just Googled this, and it says that Latin did not die out suddenly. It evolved into modern Romance languages like French, Spanish, and Italian. Although the Catholic Church preserved it as a how do you even pronounce that? Administrative language, we'll say. It fell out of daily use as spoken dialects drifted. Formal education declined after the fall of the Roman Empire, and the Protestant Reformation encouraged the use of local native language. So there you have it. It didn't die out. It basically evolved. So there you have it. It wasn't just a thing that happened overnight. Anyway, here we go. Let's give a roundup and a final thought. We'll start with you, Natty, then Ansari, then me, and then finally Sasha will have the final say.
Sorry, I'm still arguing in chat with someone about Berserk, but
I'm sending you the link tonight. And if you haven't watched 10 parts by tomorrow morning,
Hold on. I've got a list as long as my arm now of art and various things I need to check out from the book. So I'm afraid Berserk is at the bottom of that list. And it comes from Japan, not from Europe. So,
Natty, I don't know if you've seen, but Blair Cottrell has just got into Dragon Ball Z and is like,
"Oh my god!"
Best thing ever.
So
you're lucky. Blair isn't going to be the conference speaker this year, or you'd be getting double teamed by me and him. We'd both be shouting at you in Japanese.
I know the typical enjoyer of Dragon Ball Z, and it's not European nationalists. So I don't know.
If Blair made a good point, because he's just got into it and he posted a lengthy thing. Now's not the time for this. Maybe we could have a bit of a debate.
No, I did see the post, and I shook my head and sighed into my coffee when I saw it. But
no, but there is a if you watch Dragon Ball Z, there are extensive speeches that are all about the importance of race, heritage, you know, pride in your race. All of these things are sort of woven into it, and I know it's meant to be for kids, but it does give a very, very interesting perspective on what kids watch in the West and what the message is for Western kids and what kids watch in Japan. So if you're a child and you're brought up in Japan and you've got these two people standing in the ruins of a city that they've just smashed to pieces fighting, and one of them's bellowing at the other that like he's never going to give in because he's the last of his race and he won't let his pride in his people die that easily, and you're in the West, and then a kid in the West is sat there and they're watching, you know, the Multicultural Heroes Hour, it's a very different sort of thing, isn't it? You know, however much you say, well, I don't particularly like that, there is a very different narrative there. I mean,
well, that's all well and good, but if I try and watch it, I'm going to have a seizure. I've seen clips of it before, so, you know, I don't want to be rolling.
It takes
on
a while. Dragon Ball Z is a slow burn, and it takes a while to get into. Berserk's amazing. Look, give us your thoughts. We said we weren't going to run over tonight, and you're going to make us run over, and I'll be tired.
To sum it up, I think it's a European nationalists kind of love letter to our history and our culture and art, and reads in some places like a travel guide, and that's how I'll take it. And certainly the ideas and the pictures and the thoughts you've put down onto the paper will be with me if I ever visit any of these places, which I intend to do. The inn at Breslau just looks and sounds amazing. That stuck with me. So, yeah, highly recommended. Highly recommended.
Right. Well, I mean, look, even if you're a reasonably intelligent peasant like me, a non-academic, buy the book and spend real time actually looking into and looking at everything he recommends, the art, the poem, the poet, all the names of the poets, the art, the architecture, and do the visits as well if you fancy going to Europe. It's just really worth it. It's opened my eyes to a world that I've really ignored, and shame on me for that. But it's not never too late, as Sasha said. I'm just really grateful and feel blessed to have been given the honour of reading it, Sasha. So thank you.
Well, thank you so much. Draven J gave another $10 and said, $10 for the old swordsman. Well, thank you so much. Definitely the oldest, but still also the sharpest. Little dig there at Natty. Needs to up his game. Needs to up his game, guys. Anyway, back to the book. The book's superb, and I really like it. And I really like it primarily for one reason. Not just that it's well written, not that just because Sasha's my friend and such a wonderful person, but because when you open this book, it boldly states that it isn't trying to be an encyclopedic work of European art. The book isn't trying to be this, you know, 2,000 page, multiple volume masterwork that explains every single thing that Europeans produced from the days of, you know, Greco-Roman empires right through to modern day degeneracy. It's one man's view of the world and the things that inspired him and mean a lot to him, and his takes on that, and his takes on how he thinks the things that inspired him inspired our people. And that makes the book, rather than being a cold, almost lifeless narrative that assesses things in a very educational and academic way, it takes the book to being something that feels like it has a warmth. And many books written about topics such as art and architecture aren't warm. They aren't approachable. They aren't books that you can pick up and read. They're books that are, and I think you noted this in your prologue, most academic books on art, architecture, and literature are not written for the public. They're actually written for other academics. So an academic can pick up another academic's book and go, "Ooh, I praise your academic book, but you've missed this. But you also said this that I missed." And these academics have this big circle jerk that most people can't get into. And this book's written by a normal man for other normal men. And I really like it. I recommend everyone picks it up. It's very, very good value for money. And Sasha obviously gets extra points, not just for being a fantastic guy, but also for being someone who managed to write the book in two different languages himself, which is a feat far beyond anything that I've managed. So, you know, overall, Excellent book. Go out and get it. Sasha, you're the man of the hour. Have the final say, then we'll shut it down.
Thank you very much for those extraordinary kind words. I appreciate that highly. That book, read it as a defiant strike aimed at forging a counter-consciousness against those establishment demons of decay today. And take it as an offer to escape the raging tide of the zeitgeist to the shores of true culture.
Superb. Well, look, I just want to thank everyone for being here tonight. I want to thank Natty, Sally, and of course, Sasha. It's been a wonderful review, a great night. We've had lots of intellectual chat as well as some fun chat and a bit of banter. That's always the way when Sasha's here. If you've seen the picture of me, Sasha, and Blair stood shoulder to shoulder, it's a funny picture because Blair completely dwarfs me, but then Sasha dwarfs both me and Blair. He is truly a titan amongst normal men, and not just physically, but also for his work and his superb personality and sense of humor. Thank you for being here, Sasha. Thank you also to Natty and Aunt Sally. Thank you to everyone who donated so generously. And thank you to everyone who tuned in and enjoyed the show. It's been a really good one. This is what Sunday nights are all about. I want to thank everyone. Enjoy your weekend, whatever's left of it. And I will be back next week for Patriotic Weekly Review. Thank you all. Love you. Look after yourselves and good night.